Thank you, Alessia. So I'm spontaneously filling a gap in the program, but then it turned out it's actually good as an introduction for the Psi Winter School. So I speak a bit on Lorentzian quantum gravity and effective spin forms. And it will be basically a two-part talk. And for the second part, it's based on these papers together with Cesar Santer and Hai Haggard. And here you can see us simulating successfully triangle. So I will start with a reinterpretation and a rush through history of the quantum gravity path integral and explain how we went from Euclidean to Lorentzian and maybe have a few surprises. Then I hope there's time to explain a bit effective spin forms and show numerical results about testing the feasibility of these effective spin forms. So basically, I will speak about the path integral approach to quantum gravity, where here we really concentrate on the so-called non-perturbative background independent path integral, where the idea is that you define a configuration space of geometries, which you kind of build either from graphs or from actually piecewise linear geometries or from any kind of other objects you think is might be fundamental, or you get such a configuration space from regulating smooth geometries and would then study the path integral with a regulator and try to remove this regulator to see that the results then again produce smooth geometries in some kind of semi-classical semi-classical limit or limit involving many building blocks and or a limit in which you actually remove the regulator. So that is in itself quite undefined. You have to specify lots of choices, lots of things, including the space of geometries, a measure on the space, either discrete or continuous. If it's continuous, you have all kinds of measure terms you can put or not put, the kind of geometries. And there are already so many choices here. So here I will also just concentrate on using some kind of a discretization of the Einstein-Hilbert action in your amplitude term. So I'm using the path integral. That doesn't mean that I think the canonical approach or the Hamiltonian approach is useless. Actually, I do think you can, it's just describing the boundary data or spaces you should have for the path integral. And if you can adopt, you can, if you're suitable, adapted, you can probably also describe things in a Hamiltonian language and possibly even things like topology change. So one way to regularize the path integral also is using so-called Ricci calculus, which is a way to regularize, discretize smooth geometric manifolds. It was introduced by Tullio Ricci a long time ago, 1961, and then indeed used for simulations. So here the space of geometries are so-called piecewise flat geometries, that is triangulations. And what you sum over are the length variables which are attached to the edges of these triangulations. And doing so specifies a geometry on the space of on this triangulation. Here you see the idea is that if you have the length of all this geometry of all the edges in this piece of geometry, it determines the angles at this vertex. And if you glue these triangles together, you get the deficit angle, which is basically the defect from 2 pi to be flat. And that gives you a measure for curvature in 2D. If you go to 3D, this occurs always around an edge. And in 4D, the situation is basically played around a triangle. And these objects are on which you can have curvature called bones. The discretization of the Einstein-Hilbert action is just then given by this measure for curvature integrated over basically the region where it's concentrated. So that gives you the volume of the bone. So in 1D, it would be just actually one, and in 3D, it would be the length of the edge, and in 4D, the area of the triangle. So this stretchy action is indeed a discretization of the Einstein-Hilbert action. I've given here the term for all the bulk bones. There are boundary terms. So if your bone is in the boundary, you have to decide in principle how to chop up your 2π. But then you have basically terms which more or less give you the extrinsic curvature. And you can chop up the 2π in a way where you would declare thin and thick wedges. And then you attach a pi to the thick wedge, with keeping in mind that you glue two thick wedges together. And actually that's, you obviously see it's additive, this action, and this kind of getting these boundary terms, even for singular configurations, it's much easier than the continuum. Okay, so we would like to compute in principle this path integral with an I, but it's basically impossible, or it has in particular been impossible in the past for configurations which would be relevant for the continuum limit, that is if you have really many edges. And additionally, as you will see, the integration range is actually infinite. So instead, people turn to basically the one way to evaluate non-perturbative path integrals, which is Monte Carlo sampling. Unfortunately, that works only for positive measures. That is, if you have not exponential is, but exponential s or minus s. And that minus s or minus the so-called Euclidean action comes around in usual quantum field theory if you rotate your time parameter. And so in spirit, it was thought that you could also rotate basically time, whatever that means, in quantum gravity, that is the time coordinate, and you would get basically the Euclidean Einstein-Hilbert action, that is action you would sum instead of Lorentzian geometries over Euclidean geometries. And that would define you, give you results for quantum gravity, and then you needed kind of to still interpret how to apply that in case to any theory of Lorentzian quantum gravity. There are, however, two big problems for this approach. One is practical, and it is basically really a new feature from gravity, which is that the Euclidean Einstein-Hilbert action is unbounded from below. So there's a so-called conformal factor or conformal mode, which comes with a wrong sign in the kinematic return. And for that reason, basically, your system is in great danger to always fall into the region where you maximize this negative conformal mode. And there's a big conceptual problem that is the space of Lorentzian geometries is very different from the space of Euclidean geometries. So there's actually no precise sense how these two spaces can be related via even a coordinate dependent rotation. And in my view, basically, in particular, the so-called practical one, which is the conformal factor problem, basically killed almost all Euclidean quantum gravity approaches, these non-perturbative ones, that is Euclidean rigid calculus, so-called dynamical triangulations. And there have been also other basically Euclidean lattice gauge formulations of gravity where you saw the same thing happening again and again. So you can actually ask what any of these Euclidean versions tell us about the 2i quantum version of the various path integral formulations. Either if you do actually a path integral with exponential I s with over Euclidean geometries or over Lorentzian geometries. And to illustrate that, Let's consider actually one example, so-called spikes in Ricci calculus, and these are exactly the configurations which kind of tend to maximize your Euclidean action, or minimize in the sense that minus the Euclidean action gets maximal. So these spikes, you can produce them by taking a vertex in your triangulation, and in this picture, it's a 2D triangulation, and moving this vertex in some sense in a higher dimension, if you think of that, so that all the edges adjacent to this vertex get very long. It turns out, that first you can have these configurations, the triangle inequalities do not forbid these configurations. And second of all, if you consider the action in 3D and 4D, and 2D is kind of constant, so then minus the Euclidean action, or minus this action for Euclidean configuration, does the following thing. You see it here. It just goes unbounded, and the length can be basically arbitrarily long, going to infinite. So what we found out here for this example, which is an example for 4D triangulation with certain symmetry reductions, that actually the action is behaving basically linear if you go to sufficiently large lengths. And also it's a symmetry reduction that will be actually a generic feature for the just because if you really go for large lengths and see this example, all the lengths at this vertex will be actually having the same length. So this is really the behavior for a 4D triangulation. In the left picture, you just see that with the two length parameters which we have in this problem, there's basically the triangle inequalities. There's an infinite region where you can integrate over, and the action grows linearly in basically the average length parameter. And actually, you can just easily write a toy model which models this behavior. So this would be computing the length expectation value for one of the edges together with the measure term. And so if you do that with the Euclideanized version, you get an exponential factor, exponential plus x. So you can put any kind of polynomial measure, but what will happen if you choose a cutoff for your integral, which you do have if you really put the Ricci action, you have to do a numerical integration, then what you will find is that your expectation value of your length is basically given by the maximal length you have in the system, but that is by cutoff. Or in other words, your expectation value for the length is actually infinite. If you choose exponential IS and actually have also put a measure which kind of suppresses large lengths for at least a range of expectation values of lengths to some power, your expectation values will converge to some finite value. The more suppressing your measure, the faster it will converge. If you don't put this measure, your expectation value basically will oscillate with the cutoff, and then you have to find another way to make sense out of oscillating expectation value. But here it's really that with an appropriate choice of measure, you will find a finite expectation value, and actually the basically very near to the classical value. There's some shift which comes from this infinite integration, which in this example here is very small. But you do find basically the classical solution despite this infinite integration range in this your expectation value. But with the Euclidean version, which has been used for the simulations, of course, many people were convinced that this does not work. And so we can again ask, you know, we would not know what would happen if we use the Euclidean version, or whether such spikes can actually appear in Lorentzian geometries. So after people tried out Euclidean Red J cavity, there was a move to so-called dynamical triangulations. That for a simple reason avoids these spike configurations. And the idea here is just instead of integrating over length variables associated to a fixed triangulation, we encode the geometry in the way the triangles and the simplices are glued together. And again, you can here take a triangulation where all edge lengths are the same, but if you have 5 triangles around one vertex in 2D, you will find a curvature. And if you have 7, you will also find a curvature. But if you have 6, you have a flatness at this vertex. So here it's really the way in which the triangles or the higher dimensional simplices are glued together that geometry is encoded in that. And that method clearly avoids very long edges. So you could think the problem of spikes is solved, but the empire strikes back. So what happens is actually that these simplices, they organize themselves together into a behavior which is very similar to the spikes. Namely in this picture, as you can see, so there's many simplices. It's from a 4D simulation. And these many simplices, they tend to branch off in lots of these so-called baby universes. So if you zoom in, you know, there's lots of branchings of little universes. And that is one phase which you find in these simulations. So in the dependence of kind of two coupling constants you can choose here, the Newton constant and the cosmological constant. And this has some Hausdorff dimension like 2. And there's another phase where basically there's a region where each vertex is connected, one vertex is almost connected to, is connected to almost every other vertex. And it has Hausdorff dimension infinity. And so none of these phases gives you kind of a smooth manifold. And furthermore, in particular in this paper, it's confirmed that the phase transition is first order. So that didn't work either. So then Jan Ambjørn and Renate Loll suggested causal dynamical triangulations. And here the idea or the remark I made that Lorentzian geometries could be very different from Euclidean geometries is taken seriously. So here the key input is actually the idea that a regular causal structure would not allow for these branching of baby universes. And we will also see that later in more detail. So the idea is actually to demand a regular causal structure. And then the claim is for such geometries, it's possible to Wick rotate them individually, each configuration. And you can still use Monte Carlo simulations. So there's a somewhat similar philosophy in causal sets, but I will not comment on that further. And I will present here a version which is not very well known, unfortunately, but has been actually also simulated in 3D with the same result as in the other version. So the version which is better known is that there's a preferred, kind of a preferred slicing, which looks like a proper time slicing. The more general version is that you take a certain type of simplices with space-like edges and time-like edges. All time-like edges have the same length. All space-like edges have the same length. And you glue them together in all kinds of ways, But there is a condition, and the condition is that each vertex or each bone, if you're in higher dimensions, each space-like bone carries exactly two light cones. So it cannot carry less, a smaller number of light cones, and it cannot carry three or four light cones. And here you're supposed to see an example with three light cones. And indeed, if you have this branching of baby universes, I will again show you later also that this is associated with having more than two light cones at a point. So basically that was a condition that really forbid this generation of baby universes. And it has been shown in a number of publications that this is really something which would basically destroy the phases shown, which would show up in this CDT. And indeed what you find is a phase, or actually several phases, where you have something like a smooth geometry and actually the zeta phase. There's lots of interesting results, which you can kind of listen to, finding talks by Renate Loll on Pearson. There's a number of open questions, in particular in the preferred slicing version, because the model has been described as an effective action, which is Ojala-Lifshitz, which doesn't mean it is all Ojala-Lifshitz, because you could still go to some ends of phase transition lines, and could be GR, where the symmetry is restored. Would be interesting to have the 4D simulations with this more general version. But still, there's actually an interpretational problem, namely the interpretation of the results in a Lorentzian context, in particular for black hole spacetimes. Also, as a side remark, one has actually three coupling constants, which seems to be another important ingredient to see something reasonable. And there are also claims by Leo et al. At Syracuse that you can reproduce similar results in Euclidean dynamical triangulations if you put a measure which suppresses baby universes. Okay, so the lesson here is that Lorentzian configurations with regular causal structure can be actually very different from the Euclidean configuration space, and they can even overcome the conformal vector problem, meaning that in this CVT example, you actually do have still the conformal vector problem, but it doesn't destroy your Monte Carlo simulations. And so then the question would be, what about Lorentzian actually geometries?
Bianca, okay. There is a question by Laurent.
Yeah.
So what is the third coupling constant in CDT, EDT?
It's an anisotropy parameter. So basically the difference between space-like and time. If your time-like edge is minus one, then your space-like length is alpha, and then alpha is a coupling parameter, which we call anisotropy parameter. Okay. So Lorentzian magic calculus. So what I will tell you there is, and I will show you examples in a minute, that configurations with regular causal structure can appear, and they describe topology change. And actually, it's an effort, or it would be an effort to suppress them. And so we should, in principle, choose, should we impose it, the condition to have a regular causal structure, which we could just take as two light cones at every space-like bone, or not. I should mention that all this is inspired by a recent paper by Raphael Sorkin. And I wish every one of us could write about the same thing with 45 years of difference. But you find many of these statements and definitions in the 2019 paper. But basically the same things have been defined in the 1975 paper. So actually, you know, it turns out if you are really careful with defining a reaction for Lorentzian triangulations, it has actually imaginary parts if the light cone structure is irregular. And with a right choice of root for -1, it suppresses baby universes. So basically you have two choices and it either ends up to enhance baby universes or you suppress baby universes. And actually this coincides with a 2D continuum calculation, which was done by Raphael and Yamaloko a long time back. And it's really easy to understand. So, so the first question is, how do you define Lorentzian angles? And in the following, I restrict to the case that all space-like all subsimplices are space-like, which is not essential here, but in any case, just don't be surprised by that. So Lorentzian angles here in the plane, there is, you know, if you have a wedge or two edges which are space-like and they form a thin wedge, you can just delete that with a positive boost parameter. So here your angle is defined as a boost parameter, which is chosen to be positive, which rotates one edge into the other. However, if you have a thick edge, you know, then in fact, if you carefully continue your formulas through the complex plane, you find that your angle is negative, and you have also an imaginary contribution, which is -πi. So then your deficit angle is defined as, again, as something like this defect from the flat case. And the flat case would be that you would have an angle sum, which is exactly -2πi. So it's actually -2πi minus the sum of all the angles which meet in 2D at the vertex. So if you always glue exactly two thick wedges, you do not find any imaginary contributions. And if you glue two edges, you see two thick wedges. By definition, a thick wedge includes a light cone. You would have actually exactly two light cones at each point. You know, Raphael also shows that the Gauss-Bonnet theorem holds, and actually there is another version of the action which somehow is appeared in a paper by Barrett and Foxon. And it seems to be used in the spin form literature, which avoids these complex terms altogether, but there seems to be an implicit assumption that you indeed only glue two thick wedges. But this does not satisfy the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. So now, you know, so this also defines basically the appropriate boundary terms you should choose. And you know, you get actually everything, boundary terms, corner terms, and singular terms in this case with much more ease. And so we can look at some examples of Lorentzian triangulations. So again, I restrict here to spaces which only have space-like. So Lorentzian triangles, which only have space-like edges, if you're in 2D. So these examples are in 2D. In this case, a Lorentzian triangle has a triangle inequality, which is kind of the opposite region of the Euclidean triangle inequalities. And it says that there is one edge whose length is bigger than the sum of the other two edges. And this long edge, you know, is opposite the wedge with the light cone. So here you see then an example where, if C is bigger than 2A and D is bigger than 2B, and there's a condition on EB and A, you will find a regular light cone structure. And in these cases, if you, you know, declare your corners here to be either thick or thin, you find a vanishing imaginary part. But you can also have a triangulation with an irregular light cone structure, as you can see here. If your B parameter is larger than 2A, you can easily construct an example where you have four light cones at one point. And you can just generalize that and see that you can produce everything from 2 to infinite light cones by gluing, you know, n of these triangles together around the vertex. Here, I show you a closed triangulation, but you can also just cut it off open along one of the A edges. You see an example where there is a vertex with no light cone. So if you turn it around, and if you rotate this example, it gives you the Hartle-Hawking state, because here you have a region where you basically have an Euclidean region where you have no light cone emanating. Also, here I want, that was an illustration to show you that if you have such a Tauser diagram in 2D, that this is really a splitting of maybe of one S1 into two S1, so a splitting of baby universes. Okay, here I rotated it. So you see Hartle-Hawking wave function. So these are 2D examples, and 4D we have also constructed triangulations, a triangulation with only space-like length, and depending on the length parameters, you can either have regular or irregular causal structure. And you can easily generalize this example where you glue two simplices together. Of course, you can just generalize it to any dimension you want and get this effect of having these so-called Jarmulke configurations, which Sorkin calls Jarmulke configurations. So there's more to be understood. In these examples, and I think that's generic, the regions, in this configuration which we have, the region with regular causal structure and irregular causal structure is actually separated by a region where your parameters are not allowed by the triangle inequalities. And that is generic for a specific reason, but it's an example with only space-like length. And it would be interesting to know if that also holds if you allow time-like length. The important point is, as you see here, you get imaginary parts in your retroaction. So if you put it in your exponential IS, these configurations will become exponential minus 2 pi. And so only configurations which are, so they will be suppressed. And these configurations will be enhanced in 2D. So in 2D, it's 2 pi, and in higher dimensions, you also multiply with a volume of your bone. And so you see that topology change is already in any kind of, in this Ricci formulation. And you really do not need to add by hand a topology change. It's really just if you think you would sum over triangulations of the sphere, this sphere configuration can either describe a sphere which goes from the beginning of the universe to the end, or you can have actually this sphere basically showing us a number of irregularities apart from the beginning and endpoint, which would describe kind of joining and splitting of baby universes. okay, So as I mentioned, you know, you need to choose the right route here for this, and basically Raphael does it so that you suppress these baby universes. And it's something which you, of course, only get first in the Lorentzian case, and secondly, if you really use the exponential I action. So topology change is already included if you decide to sum over all Lorentzian geometries, but baby universes are suppressed. We can still decide to restrict to causal regular structure, or we can just allow it. And this restricting version would be introducing a bit more non-locality, because it would involve a condition which is kind of involving all simplices around the ball. What about spin forms? That's a good question. So it's not obvious in the literature, but I do think that you probably, if you would study that carefully, you would find these terms, because in principle, they seem to appear in this paper, which Barrett and Foxon, which actually studies something different. But here it really seems to be the issue that the spin form asymptotics is typically studied with for one simplex, and what you get is a rejection with boundary terms. And if you choose kind of the correct thick or thin wedge boundary terms, you do not get the imaginary terms. But if you glue these simplices together and you glue more than three thick wedges around a bone, you do get an imaginary term. So that would be nice to be confirmed. So in this case, if you include these terms, you have suppressing factors which arise here, and you do have automatically a topology change included. So that kind of summarizes my excursus on Lorentzian quantum gravity with an I. It's supposed to show you that, no, actually we cannot really rely on any of the Euclidean approaches to decide that something is excluded or not. CDT shows you that introducing Lorentzian structures can change the picture drastically from say the Euclidean picture. And they do forbid explicitly baby universes, but if that's automatically suppressed, you know, you are free to still allow it and study how big this effect is. There's kind of many open questions regarding Lorentzian configuration space and the quantum pass integral, which would be also relevant for spin forms. So what are the properties of the Lorentzian configuration space with and without regular causality? Now, what are the non-compact directions? So the Lorentzian triangle inequalities are quite different from the Euclidean ones. Are there spikes configurations with and without regularity? And so can we deal with all these, I call these spike configurations infrared divergences in the quantum path integral? And so that it looks like this Lorentzian structures help actually a lot to make at least this kind of infrared version, infrared sector well defined. Are there any questions to this part?
Yep, Bianca, hi. I have a question. You mentioned the Yarmulke's conversions are enhanced. Could you go back to that slide? I didn't get that part. Next slide.
Yeah, I'm showing you this configuration here.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay.
It's really if you do get more than two light cones, you get a positive imaginary part, a new action. Mm-hmm. And if you have a point which has less than two light cones, you get a negative imaginary contribution. So if you put this into exponential I action, this gives you exponential plus 2 pi, and this gives you exponential minus, no, sorry, the other way. So this gives you exponential minus 2 pi, and this gives you exponential plus 2 pi. Now, if you have a sphere, then by topology, I mean, in 2D here, in 2D, you have this Gauss-Bonnet theorem. So for spheres, you will always have this exact result. And also this, what I showed, actually in 2D, not change anything, but in higher dimensions, these imaginary parts will be multiplied by a volume of the bone.
And there was also a question.
There's probably, that you cannot have, you can only have a finite number of these YAR modes.
There is a question by Laurent first.
I've kind of a question about these caps and cups. So what prevents the proliferation of these creation of baby universes? The topology change is suppressed, right? As you're saying, but these ones enhance this.
That you just produce spheres. That's what you mean.
Yeah, and you could. There's no.
Number of spheres in some sense,
Yeah.
In 2D, but it separates spheres. No, I mean you need to keep them separate, because as soon as you join them, you would have a Tauser.
When you join them, is it that where the number of topology change always suppress more the creation or something like that?
I read this paper very recently, so I have not studied all these examples. But in 4D, certainly all these questions, which would be nice to discuss, and I'm saying they are already there. I do believe your answer is that, if you consider a fixed sphere after this example, in some sense, if you start with two YAR modes and say, but I want to join them, then still you get a sphere. So that is not, you don't have any problem, because for the sphere in 2D, you would just get the Gauss-Bonnet contribution would be constant in higher dimensions. It's a good question.
You would tend to produce, to favor creations of big spheres, right?
I believe Raphael has maybe talked about it. But of course, it gives you also the Hartle-Hawking function very naturally in some sense. with an Euclidean region here, so anyway. Okay, Carlo, a fast question, because otherwise I have 15 minutes left and I have a second talk.
No, I don't have a question, sorry.
Okay.
There was just some noise coming out, sorry.
Bianca, there is also an anonymous question.
Okay.
Quickly, probably. So how can we big rotate when the Euclidean action over the geometry is not a reflection positive definite, or do we work directly with the Lorentzian action without reconstructing from the Euclidean?
If you do Lorentzian geometries, you directly work with Lorentzian action. I'm a bit lost with this question. So I advertising using Lorentzian for the Lorentzian case, the Lorentzian action. So actually for me, it was kind of a surprise. So in Reggie, topology change is already excluded. It actually takes effort to exclude it. And also in spin forms, it is included already. And as I said, it would be good to confirm that it's actually, you have these imaginary terms, or not to confirm. I do think they should arise. And then there's another question, what happens with the sum over orientations? And actually, you can also study that for 3D, where everything might be much simpler, but then it's a 2R 3D model. And there seems to be half an answer, because in this paper I mentioned, that study is actually the other way around. It starts with the Euclidean version, but finds Lorentzian contribution. And if you put all the I's here, if you complex continue that, you will find basically something which is this story here, just that, you know, there are kind of, at some point, absolute values, and it's a bit hard to study the science. In any case, I have a short time left to study that. So that's saying there's actually lots of unexplored things, and even just Lorentzian Reggie. And these would be important also to figure out if you want to understand what properties of your path integral spin forms have. And and it would be important to answer kind of these questions, like Laurent's questions. Okay, I will run through introducing you to spin forms and effective spin forms. So why spin forms? As I said, you have many choices of your path integral, so that you could actually decide to inform your choice for the path integral by a rigorous notion of quantum geometry, which here I mean really something coming out from a quantization of geometry, if you want to have it more precisely, quantization of geometry, your geometric algebra of operators. In some sense, you can see that as modeling more the UV properties of your configuration space. There are other things which you might find very attractive, like deep connections to topological quantum field theories. And actually that gives you already something like a flat, smooth looking face if you don't look sharply enough, if you don't look too sharp at it in 4D and also in 3D, it gives you actually 3D quantum gravity as a topological quantum field theory, which is basically what it classically is supposed to be for Einstein quantum gravity. Another problem that it addresses is that if you take Reggie configuration space, it's actually very hard to quantize rigorously because it's a very complicated space due to triangle inequalities and positivity requirements of your matrix. And actually, it is the same problem for the continuum matrix. So the solution is to embed the space in some sense in a higher dimensional version. By, for instance, using triads or tetrads. And you see here that the matrix written as a contraction of triads or tetrads, that makes your matrix manifestly, say, positive in the Euclidean case, or manifestly, whatever, semi-positive in the Lorentzian case. And then, in fact, the triangle inequalities, actually only the lower dimensional ones, are implemented with the Gauss constraint or the local rotation symmetry. And this strategy works wonderfully for 2+1D gravity because more or less it leads to BF, which is a topological field theory, or John Simons, or Ponzano-Reggie, or Tour review, and so on. There is a price to pay by going to these reformulations. Typically, you will find more configurations and you extend your configuration space. So that can include degenerate sectors, some of orientations, Lorentzian geometries, and Euclidean signature, and vice versa, and so on. And there's an even bigger enlargement of the configuration space in 3+1. So for 3+1 quantum geometries, you know, we start with a triad in for the three-dimensional subspace, but actually we want to apply the Hodge dualization for reasons which are that you want to have a variable which is canonically conjugated to a connection, And then you do get so-called fluxes, whose geometric interpretation is that they give you the normals to surfaces or the normals to the triangles in the context of a triangulation. And these fluxes, because it's conjugated to an SU2 connection, you know, they will be two SU2 Lie algebra valued. So that means the components are non-commutative. And still, it just gives you the geometry. It encodes just the geometry of your spatial hypersurface, you would think. So it turns out that this geometry has some non-commutative features. And then another concept we need are simplicity constraints, which actually ensure that these normals do arise from a consistent association of vectors associated to the edges. So you have these simplicity constraints, but your spatial geometry or your fluxes are non-commutative. And that actually leads to an anomaly in your algebra of constraints describing these in your simplicity constraints. So actually part of these simplicity constraints are not implemented on the quantum gravity Hilbert space. And the Hilbert space actually describes generalized geometries which include a certain type of torsion. But if you want to evolve them dynamically with the kind of action we usually use, you need to implement these constraints in order to avoid getting actually a dynamics which is not GR. And the solution to this problem is to use a coherent state or weak implementation in the path integral, which has been done in 2007 by either by EPL, so Engel, Pereira, Valli, Levine, or Friedel, Krasnov, based on some early ideas of Levine Speziale. And so that was originally done on the level of these fluxes in some sense. And recently we have done a more effective version in some sense by working with rotation invariant variables, which are encoded in these fluxes, which are areas and angles. But it relies on the same idea. So we have these simplicity constraints, which do not commute, and we impose them weakly. And interesting, well, actually, there are recent papers which kind of argue for something similar, namely to include torsion in your configuration space, even in many superspace. And Magogeo and Slosnik argue that this makes your Kodama state normalizable. And it actually also works with a coherent state average over your torsion degrees of freedom. So I don't want to get into the technical details. The main thing is, in the end, your amplitude is given by an oscillating factor, which is exponential of your action, which is defined over this enlarged configuration space, times some Gaussians which implement your constraints. So these are peaked on a region where your constraints are valid. And the spread of this Gaussian is determined by the commutation relations of your constraint. And in this case, it is proportional, depending on which variables you use. It's proportional to gamma, but divided by the area of your triangles. Sorry, I have a random progression of my slides. It turns out, however, that if you have these weak constraints, you need to adjust the notion of semi-classical regime. So sending h bar to zero is not sufficient. We will see the reason in a minute. You need also to demand that actually the anomaly is sufficiently small, which is maybe not too surprising that this is necessary for a semi-classical limit. So the reason why h bar going to zero is not surprising is the following. You have a situation where you have exponential I action, and you have your Gaussian implementing constraints. And here we are in a situation where really the action is changing, it's not stationary, around the region where you want to constrain your system, because the constraints are actually in the action exactly for the reason that the action is not stationary without these constraints. And these oscillations are the stronger, the smaller h bar is. And so at some point, these oscillations in some sense will average out these Gaussians, and you lose the effect of these Gaussians. And you can make a naive estimate on what is the condition of this effect not happening, which is that you should not have too many oscillations over the interval over which the Gaussian is spread. And that kind of holds for all such systems in which you implement secondary constraints. But in the case of spin forms, at least to an estimate, again, it's naive, which involves the area or the spin, the Barbera-Nisi parameter and epsilon, sorry, so far, the area. Okay, and so indeed we needed to test whether, you know, we actually find a semi-classical regime for spin forms using the effective spin form model. And just in the last, I think, 3 minutes, I will try to show you these results. A detail which I actually haven't mentioned it is that the areas turn out to have discrete spectrum, and we implement that in our models. And this discreteness is also parameterized by gamma. And if you put everything together, you can shift your gamma dependence if you shift from areas to spins. So spins here, we use this half integer values. You shift the dependence on gammas to the action, whereas your Gaussian will be gamma independent if you think in terms of J. Okay, so here is actually a first example. So we can do that also for Lorentzian and Euclidean signature. Lorentzian, it's for the case that every subsimplex is space-like. And here is an example for Lorentzian signature for a triangulation with one bulk area. You have a deficit angle, which is 0.6. And kind of a huge spin. What you see here is the absolute value of your action, and I show that for the spin form of aficionados, because you actually see this funny maxima structure, and these maxima actually occur at this condition where the background value of your, that is the classical value of your deficit angles time gamma, is a multiple of 2 pi. And that comes out also spin form asymptotics. And the simple reason is that this condition, you know, gives you a condition for the discretization where the discretization produces so-called pseudo-stationary points. So if we would plot the continuous action, it looks like in this picture, but you know, you sample this action or this exponential of E action only over the discrete points. And if you do that for this value of gamma, you know, around 10, you would actually see that these points, you sample them such that you get something which looks like a stationary point, but it is not, it's only because of the discretization. And you can also basically derive this condition from thinking in these terms. But these maxima actually have nothing to do with your semi-classical regime. If you compute the expectation value of your area, it is basically reproducing the classical value in a regime which goes to gamma equals 0.5 or somewhat smaller. So it's really a really small regime in this diagram. Here you see the expectation value of the deficit angle. So that is also roughly the correct one until gamma equal to 0.4. And then it actually goes back to the flat value. So I skip these Euclidean results, which look almost
Bianca, sorry. Can you say what's the conclusion of that? Because that's exactly what was bothering me. That's exactly the point that I.
That's why I'm showing you that.
Yeah. So can you not repeat the story, but repeat your conclusion about that? That's exactly the point where I. What is the conclusion from that? So I didn't get the bottom line, probably.
So we do see exactly this epsilon gamma is the peaks.
Yeah.
That, you know, we do get them.
Yeah.
And it comes from this discreteness of your summing over only discrete values. But actually, you know, when these maxima appear, it's a gamma regime which is way outside of your semi-classical regime.
I see. So you say that the two things cannot go to. Is this does not save your way? Does not save you.
It does not save you. I mean, here gamma equal to 10 is a bit ridiculous, large value of gamma, but it comes out of this number. In some sense, you get more unstable results when you have a destructive interference, and here you have a kind of constructive interference, and your destructive interference appears before your constructive interference, if you get.
Oh, great. This is great. I wish we had more time to learn the details of that, of course, but this is not the right moment. Yeah, sure. Thank you. But this is great.
We can discuss. I want to show you,
but that's exactly what I wanted to know about this. Yeah, thank you.
I skip a lot of other graphs. We have a similar structure for examples where we study, it's now Euclidean in inner edge, where we have actually several areas and several epsilons, and we see also these maxima. And then it's actually hard to interpret even your condition. I mean, the only way I can interpret this condition would be that these epsilons have been, you know, the ratios of all these epsilon should be entire numbers, which would be also very bad. But these maxima do not appear for any of these things. You know, so it's we do not know how to describe these maxima. That's what I'm saying. And it's not this condition which is derived in the spin-Fermat products, which indeed, you know, if you think about it, would mean that this condition has to hold for every epsilon. And that means that all your epsilons are kind of in ratios, which are entire numbers. So it's a bit weird. So there's more to be understood in higher dimensional examples where you have more area things. But the upshot is, and you can study lots of wonderful plots with wonderful features, which not all of which we understand. In this paper from November, is that in each case we do find a semi-classical regime. So it's a small regime. It's a range of gammas where we reproduce with the expectation values the classical values, and the semi-classical regime overall is characterized by your spin or by your area, by your curvature and by your Barberio-Emesica parameter, which has to be in a certain range depending on your curvature and your areas. It's not always a simple criterion I showed. In particular for small curvatures, we do get a much bigger regime of gammas for which we can reproduce classical solutions. So in particular for smaller curvatures, the allowed range for gamma gets actually larger. We seem to also see that the example with an edge where we have a much more complicated triangulation looks better than the one with one area. So there are positive signs for showing that, you know, spin forms work in a sense. But there's of course a crucial question how do these weak constraints behave under cross-graining if you want to do the continuum limit? Okay. So that's a summary and outlook. Maybe the reactions have shown you, I mean, I was surprised. So Lorentzian quantum geometry already includes topology change. And we should understand all these processes better to kind of predict what will happen with your path integral. You know, you could also explicitly forbid these processes, which actually in spin forms is will be hard. They are kind of naturally included. It's easier in these effective models because we have access, much easier access to the geometric variables. So there's lots of things to study, even on the level of Lorentzian Ricci geometries. And on the level of effective spin forms, you know, we can do these numerical computations, at least for kind of triangulations with a finite number of building blocks. Indeed, you know, now we can test a number of these issues. What happens if you include some orientations, if you play around with topology change, and so on. And so far, we have always found a semi-classical regime. It does constrain gamma. You know, then independently, you can read the papers by João Marugeo and arguing about, and actually also deriving some phenomenological effects from including torsion. And there's lots of work to be done to, for instance, fix the measure terms, which you can do by going to more and more complicated triangulations. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Bianca, for this very interesting talk. Okay, so now are there questions from students?
Yeah, I have a quick question. I used to know this, but I forgot what it means. What does it mean to impose the constraints weakly?
No, it's actually language. I'm not sure it's done yet.
Okay.
So here it means we are not imposing them as delta functions. In fact, it's impossible because they are non-commuting, the so-called second class. So this commutator of the constraints gives you some number. And that means you cannot impose both constraints. Actually, there's a pair always, it comes as a pair. You cannot operate, you cannot set x and p equal to zero at the same time on your Hilbert space because they are non-commuting. So what you can do is, however, choose a coherent state which minimize uncertainty and is peaked on x equal to zero and p equal to zero. So that's what it means. You, instead of a delta function, you have a Gaussian. It can be also understood a bit more naively using the discrete spectrum. If you do express the constraints in the areas, they're actually constraining the areas. So they're functions between the areas. But the areas are discrete. And if you look at these functions, and you know, set them to zero, these will be Diophantine equations. And so if you would only select areas which satisfy these constraints, you would almost find no examples. And so weakening these constraints allows you to find you know, sufficiently many examples to get actually a suitable configuration space. And we have explicitly tested that in the April paper. So
okay.
We have explicitly counted that. So you can just understand it from, you know, the discreteness of areas is also an impediment to the imposition of these sharp constraints.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay, next there is a question by Ding and then Carlo.
Hi, Bianca.
Yeah.
The question is about motivations. As you mentioned, CDT had some successes for Lorentzian geometry. So what are the motivations to explore alternatives? Do you expect to do better in some aspects?
We should ask everyone else, which does not do CDT. I find these results quite interesting, one thing it does rely still on Monte Carlo simulations, so you could a bit question that. Another thing is, I believe that it will be on the long term, maybe on the very long term, more convenient to have explicit parametrization of your geometries, which is quite hard to get in CDT. So on spin forms or on retching, at least you have lengths and you can look at the coarse graining of these variables. All this has to be worked out much more explicitly in CDT. As I said, in principle, the results are very interesting and encouraging. And actually, you can take it as an encouragement that Lorentzian structures do help you to regularize your path integral. There is a question, and I want to leave that open. Is it Rojava-Lifshitz or is it GR? Meaning that the preferred slicing does seem to introduce some non-covariance, if you want. At least if you work with those non-covariance thing. For some people it's kind of some philosophical differences, but yeah. So for me, I think for spin forms, the most attractive feature is a connection to topological quantum field series, which basically gives you at least a topological phase, which in some sense you can consider as a smooth phase already. And it gives you lots of tools to study the continuum limit. It makes things more complicated, but in the end, it boils down on the numerical side that it's hard to evaluate Lorentzian path integrals, but some techniques are actually developing, so we might make progress with that and be much, much better in studying these things, because it has almost not been studied. That is basically, that's why Euclidean, that's why we do Monte Carlo simulations with these Euclidean versions.
Next, there is a question by Carlo.
Yeah. Thank you. Am I muted? No. Thank you, Bianca. This was very nice. A question is the following. In the alternative model, the APRL, you have the slide there. We're trying hard to do some numerical calculation in tentative physical applications like the black to white hole transition of the early universe. In many people involved, Pietro Francesco, Pietro Paolo. Many people are. Have you thought if with this effective speed for model? Something the same problems could be addressed, or is that too early, or is that
well, definitely
not reasonable?
You can do the same study, because it is easier to compute this. So.
Right. That's
a good point. I wanted to know, because is the model? I mean, it includes EPL. Does it work at all? Is it giving you the flat dynamics or not?
Sorry? It's a different question. It's not about what EPRL does. In those physical situations, can you test this effective spin for model and see if they give the difference or similar results of what, for instance, the fluctuations in the early state of the universe or the black to white transition? Can you do this thing? Have you tried? Have you thought about doing this?
We have not started it yet. But we can do that in principle. It should be going faster than.
So you don't think there are. You haven't talked about, but you don't see a difficulty in trying to go in that direction. It could be done.
It could be done. What was the work now is to define the Lorentzian version, and then I already came across a couple of surprises. And to test whether the model gives you the right equation of motion.
Yeah.
Which has not been done at this level or for spin forms.
So you somehow at some point we want to see genuine quantum gravity effects. So for instance, in the case of the end of the black hole, you think one could try to see if there is a transition to from black hole to white hole. This is what we're trying to do. So that would be very good to see, to see if there's anything similar, just because that would be going. I mean, if you have an effective tool that you can do numerical calculation with, I think it's better to try to see what it predicts, not just. I understand that you say, well, let's see if it is consistent, but you know, we want to get numbers, get physics.
So we did this consistency test.
Good, great.
And but you can apply it to these things. Mm-hmm. So you're working also with a original version with EPL. So all your things are space-like, all your substantiations.
Yeah, for the moment, both the numerical application to early cosmology, sort of the different way of viewing this. One way is the transition from nothing to a state and see how much fluctuations you end up with, how much correlations in the early universe. That's one application. I mean, this is a sort of Francesco and Francesca have been working on that. And then we're trying to set up the black to white hole transition. That's interesting because naively there is infrared divergences appearing naively in the calculation.
We
sort of some very vague argument for the moment, which I'm not sure about, that it's not appearing, but you know, we haven't gone into this. So one thing we want to do is the first thing is to see that we actually get number. And that would be interesting to see when and how the black hole can do this transition. So do we really, does the theory really tell us that there is this jump from this classical geometry to another classical geometry, which is not allowed by Einstein equations, but could be allowed by quantum gravity?
Yeah, anyway, I would say the even much easier thing is to study it in Lorentzian
matching.
Sorry for interrupting, but so we have 10 minutes left, and there is one more question by Laurent, but in any case, we will have a discussion afterwards. So, first, Laurent, do you have a question?
Yeah, it's a question maybe about the first part. Maybe en passant, a remark to Ding. It's about, have you thought about specializing to 3D gravity? I mean, one answer to Ding is that in 3D, you know, the dynamical triangulation doesn't give you anything, and then the spin foam is exactly solvable. So now, I mean, we know, as you know.
As 3D, so depending on the dimension you look at, 3D is a big success in spin forms in the sense that it does give you that gravity is topological, and dynamical triangulations as far, I have not studied the 3D case, so I cannot comment much, but it gives you a smooth phase. I'm not sure what they predict with respect to propagating gravitons or not. My understanding is also sometimes is said it could be higher curvature gravity, which would give you gravitons, higher power of curvature, for instance.
So I have a question about topology change in 3D. So, I mean, we know that if you take a spin from amplitude that violates the inequality, it becomes exponential. But I don't know if people have looked at the you know, what happens if you look at the baby universe creation?
No, that was my question. So I do think that you should get factors which either suppress it or enhance it. And if you look very carefully at Barrett and Foxon, you see that you get factors which are coming with the triangles, and where the factor associated to the triangle is exactly depending on the number of thick wedges and thin wedges. The problem with that is that Barrett and Foxon paper is about exactly the opposite case, because it's about Lorentzian configuration and the Euclidean six-stage symbol. So if you believe that you can, you know, put an I everywhere, you get exactly the result we are looking for, modulo that everything comes with a cosine. And then actually there's a phase. So there's, it's not very unique, you know, because if I cosine phi as minus one number, this kind of number of thick wedges and number of thin wedges or number of thick wedges. So I do believe it's more or less overlooked for the reason that in the spin form asymptotics it's done for one simplex and you get it, you always get it with a boundary term. But it's exactly the question, where do you attach, you know, the boundary term is only determined in the Euclidean case. If you know how many wedges you glue around a bone. Mm-hmm. So here it's also you do declare a wedge to be thick or thin, and then you put a pi there or not, an I pi there or not. And then you are real, but what happens if you glue around three thick wedges? Then you should see that popping up. It's just that I think that some implicit assumption has been made, and all the works, which are in my taste too many works on the asymptotics. I did ask around, so yeah, you can tell me, but I think it would be kind of interesting.
It would be interesting.
Very interesting to know also what happens with a sum of orientation, what happens in the other orientation. Mm-hmm. And I do think you can get an answer that it will show up. No, but it would be definitely interesting to know.
Okay, now, so I see that Ming still has a question, but we have 5 minutes left. So ask your question, or if it is a 1 minute question that requires a 1 minute answer.
I'll ask, and Bianca decides. It's about, so the first part, the Regi calculus part, all the edges are space-like. And you mentioned briefly, you want to discuss time-like edges.
No, it's only a choice here for the Regi calculus because that's what we use in the spin form thing. But you can also choose time-like things and the same results hold. You know, so you can also discuss Engels if you have time-like edges and so on.
I guess the inequalities you showed are for space-like edges.
The inequality I've shown is only true if you only have a space-like, if you have a triangle with three space-like edges. If you have time-like edge, there is no inequality, I believe.
And the conclusions, like what configurations dominate?
It's the same thing. It's independent of that. It's the same conclusion.
That's something that's not clear to me because I can imagine naively there could be some cancellations if I, you know.
No, the imaginary parts, they only depend on how many light cones you have at the point or at the bone. So every time your number of light cones at a given bone, at a space-like bone, I mean, you have only light cones at space-like bones, deviates from two, you get an imaginary part.
Could you know, if I introduce time-like edges, could there be?
No, if you have a time-like edge, this is inside a light cone, mm-hmm. by definition. So you have only this condition for space-like bones.
I see. It's okay. The imaginary part only comes in.
No, and if you have a time-like edge, then the definition of Engels is in a plane which is Euclidean, and you only get it's the same formulas as in the Euclidean case.
Okay, so I think it is a good point to stop the discussion because I think that this Zoom room will be closed automatically in 3 minutes. So okay. I think it would be nice that if you all unmute yourself to thank Bianca for the presentation and the nice discussion.
Thank you.